When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hey, everybody, welcome, and thank you for listening to this episode of Marriage Therapy Radio. My name is Zach. I'm usually here with Laura, but not today. Today, I'm here with Dr. Jennifer Grace Bird. I have known Jennifer Bird since we were in high school together. She was Jenny then. In the meantime, she has become a biblical scholar, focusing her work on what the Bible has to say about marriage. This episode might not be for you. It's definitely not for you if you don't care at all what the Bible has to say about marriage. And it might not be for you, even if you do care what the Bible says, because it might not say what you think it says. And that was what I wanted to talk to Dr. Bird about, pick her brain and just sort of understand a little bit of what is going on there. We get our second Pameo of the month, which is exciting. Also, my mother makes an appearance twice, which is kind of fun. And I just really enjoyed catching up with Jennifer Bird. I think you'll enjoy hearing how her brain works, particularly when it comes to the Bible and marriage. This is a very cool conversation. Stick around. You've been on my list for a really long time because I get this question a lot, or I get this a lot. People say, hey, just we just really want to have like a Christian marriage or biblical marriage.
Biblical marriage, yeah.
And I'm like, great. So you're going to like go to work for a year? You're going to stay home from work for a year, you know, and do that whole bit where like in the Old Testament, sort of like the husband, he just stops working and he stays home and he hangs out with them for the, that what you want?
Right.
Is that what you mean?
Do you mean that you're going to have multiple women in your bedroom at times? Like, what does that actually mean?
So here's what I want to do. I want to just like, I want you to talk. I want to ask you questions. I want also though, our listeners to appreciate that this is gonna probably stir the pot a little bit because if our conversation is anything like your book, like people are going to have to go, wait a second. Is that really how it goes? And what about this? And well, I thought, and I think we ought to do that. I think we ought to do that about the Bible. I think we ought to do that about, because I'll tell you this, I don't know if like 18-year-old me would call 49-year-old me a Christian.
Right.
Like, yeah. I just don't know if he would.
He probably would because
it's just really different the way I express and experience and feel all that. So I think let's just get to it because I'm excited about it.
I am too. I'm thrilled that you asked me to come have this conversation. So
you graduate from high school in Roanoke, Virginia. You go to college. Yeah. You change your name to Jennifer. And then what do you do next? Like what's next for you?
I was supposed to teach high school math, actually. I had a math major.
Like my mom. You're like, I'm trying to follow in the footsteps of my mentor,
heroes
Mrs.
in
Brittle.
My life, yes. Yeah. But I had a, for various reasons, I ended up going Young Life training program instead for 2 years in Virginia Beach.
Where'd you go?
Virginia Beach. Yeah.
Virginia Beach.
Kempsville. Okay. And that was tough. Like I burnt out, crushed and burned basically, and left Young Life entirely and moved out to Portland, Oregon, took my time moving out there.
When was that?
How was that?
When did you move?
That was in 97, the very end of 97.
Okay. We got here in summer of 99. So
it's wild,
kind of about the same.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And about a year after.
And why'd you go to Portland?
No, I had family there who had kind of planted the seed when I was in college. They're like, you should come here. You know, it's beautiful here. And I remember thinking at the time, oh yeah, if there's ever a phase in my life when I can go wherever I want to, you know, like to start over, I'm going to come here. And so that's what I did after Young Life.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. And that fall I was talking to, you may remember, Pam Anderson.
Yeah, sure.
On the phone. And I was still not cool with like women being ordained, even though my mother was ordained and Pam was there to be ordained, you know, like, but I needed to talk to someone who knew me a little bit. And so I called her and she, by the end of this conversation, I'm like, oh, I think I need to go to seminary. I mean, it wasn't even on my mind, right? That was fall of 97, summer of 98. I'm in Princeton, New Jersey, doing the summer language, intensive language thing, you know.
Right on. Okay, so fall of 97, Rebecca and I were married in August of 97.
Okay.
Pam and Dave were at our wedding.
Oh, were they really? Oh, that's cool.
Yeah. Yeah.
Wow.
And then you are simultaneously in in like the transition period where you're now going to, did you say Princeton?
Yeah, I was at Princeton Theological Seminary.
That's pretty sexy. Princeton's like,
yeah,
you didn't like go to like regular old seminary down the road. You went to like the seminary.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that's where Pam was. And like, I just hadn't, because I hadn't thought about it. It wasn't like I'd been looking at schools, what would be a good fit for me. And it truly, it was kind of more like, oh, I'll go, you know, and I went after the deadline for applications. I went after that. So I knew I was safe. I wasn't actually going to get it. And they still accepted my application. And I think because I was non-denominational, I checked one of those alternate boxes for them because they're very Presbyterian, you know, I think that's why I got in. I don't know. But 3 years, that just changed my world for sure. In the best of ways, I think. So I went in. Here's the thing. I went to seminary because I wanted to learn biblical languages, right?
Okay.
Because I could see that things could change. If you could look at the quote originals and see what's going on in their context, what's going on there, sometimes the translations we're given are not as accurate as you might think. Pam in particular showed me a really stunning example of that. And so that's what got me to seminary was like, if this one idea can change the way I think about this story, what else is up there? What else is out there for grabs? So I went to take Greek and Hebrew and then whatever else is fine. You know, like that was my approach to it.
So then you're done at Princeton, you graduate, and then you do what?
I started at Baylor, a New Testament PhD program at Baylor. And when I started there, when I applied there, I was probably a good fit for them. But by the time I got there, I had some of my theological ideas around like feminist theological ideas that I had been introduced to at seminary, you know, were kind of shifting things around for me. And so I ended up being a very bad fit there. It was a very, it was really intense, actually. By the end of the time there, I felt like they had crushed my critical thinking and it was not good, but it was also very, like, I'm grateful for the learning for that experience, you know?
Yeah.
I transferred to Vanderbilt, had fantastic 4 years of Vanderbilt and was just grateful every day. I woke up, you know, like grateful to be there, working with someone who was trying to teach me how to do what I needed to do, not make a little mini me, you know, which in academia, that can be a thing, you know, great time. Then I taught full time at Greensboro College, actually.
Okay.
Right out of grad school.
Yeah.
Yeah. I was there 6 years and then they were trying to keep the doors open. So they were doing everything they could, throwing stuff overboard. As many institutions are doing. It's not like that was unique. And so they cut a handful of faculty in 2013 and I was one of them. So I moved back out to Portland.
Yeah. And then how does the book come to exist?
It comes to exist that next year. I lived in my friend's basement for a year, helped her with childcare, and I wrote this book, Permission Granted.
Yeah.
Yeah. And just did a download of all of the really interesting, juicy, exciting conversations that I got to have in classrooms, you know, in intro courses to the Hebrew, the Old Testament and New Testament, which I usually refer to.
And you're not married.
Correct.
So first thing I'm going to say is, well, how come you get to have an opinion about marriage? Like, why are you the boss of this if you don't even know what you're talking about?
Totally.
Yeah.
The answer to that is because I'm talking about biblical contexts and texts.
Okay.
And I have never counseled someone on a marriage or on a relationship.
Yeah.
I listen to people. I listen to my friends. I try to learn from what they're dealing with and I respect it. And I've even performed a couple married weddings, which that feels a little weird to me too, because I'm not, but I respect these choices of theirs and I love these people and I want to be a part of their celebration. So sure. But biblically speaking, I think it actually makes me a little bit more objective. I don't think any of us are ever fully objective, Zach, but you know, we all have a bias, but I think because I'm not trying to defend something or make the scriptures say something in particular, you know, I think I'm in a sense, it's almost better that I'm not married because then I'm just looking at these scriptures for what they're saying.
What are they saying? Like, what's the secret? I got all kinds of questions, but I'll let you spiel it.
I know. I want to talk about what you want to hear me talk about.
Well, I think, again, I'm trying to figure out, like, what's going to be what do I want our listeners to feel. I want our listeners to okay, let me tell you this. This kind of started because I made a joke on a podcast a couple weeks ago, maybe a couple months ago, and one lady didn't like it. Didn't like it because she thought I was sort of alienating or isolating Christians.
Oh,
and I was
okay.
Like, well, first of all, sorry about that. Second of all, I probably was being a little snarky about it because I do have like this a little bit of contempt for sort of the generally accepted understanding of what does it mean to be like in a Christian marriage, or like I do kind of, I'm like, well, what are you talking about? And so what I want is for people to go, oh, there's things that I haven't even like thought of. And part of it is this like idea of context, right? Because if you go into the Old Testament, I don't know if you did this or if I did this, but if you go into the Old Testament and you start reading about all the things that Laura makes fun of me because I'm an alliterator. I alliterate all the times.
Okay.
This is what marriage is about in the Old Testament.
Okay.
Procreation.
Uh-huh.
Be fruitful and multiply.
Mm-hmm.
Property.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
Polygamy.
Mm-hmm.
I'll start with P. Prophet.
I'm picking up on that.
Is this you? Is this me?
That's you.
Peace. Like we're going to not have war anymore because we're going to marry our families together.
Nice. Yeah. Good.
And when most people think about like their biblical marriage that they want to have, they're not thinking about procreation, property, polygamy, profit, and peace. They're thinking about this other thing that has crept into their consciousness. And so
right.
I guess that's the thing I want to bat around a little bit.
Let's do that.
Yeah.
And I can do a simple and then elaborate however much you want to. How about that?
Yeah.
So the book I'm working on right now is called Marriage in the Bible. I do not think it means what you think it means.
Okay. Oh, right on. The subtitle is I do not think it means what you think it means.
Yeah.
Got a little, what is that? Is that
Princess Bride.
Three Stooges?
Princess Bride. Yeah. I do not think this word means what you think it means. Inconceivable.
Yeah. Right. It's a plethora, right?
Yeah.
That starts with a P.
Wait, what does?
No, it's not. What's the word that what is the word he's talking about?
I do not think.
Oh, I'm thinking about the scene from Three Stooges. No, not Three Stooges. Three Amigos, where he talks about the plethora of piñatas.
Oh, nice.
Yeah. Anyway,
I don't know that off the top of my head. Yeah.
All right. Hey, gang. If you're spending time with loved ones for the holidays, chances are you're going to hear a lot of stories. The ones you love to hear, the ones you've heard, well, too many times. I'm going home to Virginia to be with my family, my mom, my brother, their families. We're really excited about it. Last year, we gave my mom a gift that we're all very excited about. And if you're still looking for a gift idea, I can't recommend this enough. I want you to check out Storyworth. It's basically a way for your loved one to write their whole story in a fun, simple, easy way. Here's how it works. Every week, Storyworth sent my mom an email and asked her a question. She got to pick something like, what's the bravest thing you've ever done? Or what's the farthest you've ever traveled? She also got to write, for example, about her birth story, which was amazing for me to read. And all she had to do was type up a story and hit reply. After 1 year, Storyworth compiled her memories and any photos that she had and put together an exquisite hardcover book that we now have. It's been really cool to read about my mom's life and also to read it to my kids. Millions of stories have already been told with Storyworth because they make the process so simple. If my mom can do it, I mean, if my mother-in-law can do it, then your loved one can do it too. Get started with your loved one for the holidays, and before you know it, you'll both be cherishing those timeless stories for generations to come. Help your family share their story this holiday season in a way that's truly exquisite. Go to storyworth.com/MTR today and save $10 on your first purchase. That's storyworth.com, storyworth.com/MTR to save $10 on your first purchase. storyworth.com/MTR. Happy holidays and happy new year from Marriage Therapy Radio and Storyworth. So your new book.
This comes out of a decade of having conversations with people about what, air quotes, the Bible says about marriage. And so it's not like I came to this on my own. I came to this from listening to people, you know. So usually when people refer to this thing called biblical marriage, they do have four basic, if they're Christian, they do have four basic passages in mind. And it is, the first one actually is the procreation one, Genesis 1:28, be fruitful, multiply. The second is usually, in this construct, Genesis 2:24, therefore man shall leave his parents and cling to his woman,
we want to talk about that one.
Wife, right?
Yeah.
And the two become one flesh. The third is Matthew 19, 4 to 6, which is quoting Genesis 2, 24. And then we have the thing about whether or not you can, it's in the conversation about whether or not you can divorce, right? And and he says that thing about, I don't have the verses memorized right now because I always like to keep people going. Like, don't just end with this premise, which is the beginning of the conversation. But he's quoting Genesis 2, 24, and therefore what God has joined together, let no one separate.
Right. Okay.
The fourth is Ephesians 5, 31 and 32.
Right.
Which also quotes Genesis 2, 24.
Yep.
And then says, this is a great mystery, and I'm applying it to Christ and the church.
I love it. I love it. I use it all the time where I talk about how people are like, oh yeah, this is what a marriage is. It's this and this and this. See, it's right there in Ephesians. I go, yeah, but you know what the next sentence is? This is a profound mystery. Like, we have got to sleuth this thing out. We've got to put on our detective hats, because it's not just this cut and dry sort of thing that you get out of.
So yeah.
I love it. Yeah. It's my favorite. It's my favorite.
Oh dear. I might ruin your favorite for you. Can I ruin your favorite for you?
I don't know. You can't. I don't know if you can.
Okay.
Go ahead. You can try.
I would say to you, Zach, I want you to keep reading and read the next verse.
Yeah.
Because it makes it really clear that men are, women are submissive to men in the next sentence.
Okay, wait. Okay, hold on. This is a profound mystery. We're talking about Christ and the church. And then the next verse.
Yeah.
Is the one about submissive.
Yeah. It starts, that passage in Ephesians starts out by telling women to be submissive to their men, just as slaves are submissive to their masters. And it wraps up with that reminder. So, you know, you can keep whichever part of that you want, but I think it's noteworthy.
So what do you do with that though? Like, what do you do with that piece of it?
Well, I like to ask people to read the whole thing in context. And I want to talk about Ephesians 5, 21 to 33. That whole little section, because of what it's saying to women and to men, what it's saying to both of them. And I'm going to cut to the chase and say, I don't think it's entirely fair to either. I think it puts incredible stress on men to try to have to live up to the standard that's set there, even before you get to the whole thing about, I mean, Christ died for the church and men are supposed to be able to lay down their lives in the same way. Well, guess what, folks? Jesus was raised from the dead, and a man doesn't get to be raised once he's this is an unfair standard.
Yeah. I have this conversation. I used to teach this pre-married class at our church. So we were kind of into this, and that's kind of where I started first using your book. But so people will go, oh yeah, we're supposed to love like Christ loved the church. And I'm like, great. How exactly did he do that?
Exactly.
Like, what exactly did he do? You know?
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
Well, he was nice. I go, was he? Like, how was he nice? You know, or, oh, he died for them, or, oh, he sacrificed, or, oh, we have all these platitudes that we kind of can recite, but I want to appreciate exactly what that is, because that does kind of make you go, wait a second, die. I'm supposed to die. Well, guess what, folks? You don't get the second part, which is, you know, part of
it. Right. And so, well, then we want to make it metaphorical. Well, that's fine. And I'm not going to stop people from doing what they're going to do to make it work for them. I just want to be honest about what it is saying. And, you know, so for this reason, a man will leave his father and be joined to his woman to become one flesh. This is a great mystery. But I'm speaking about Christ and the church. Each of you, however, should love his woman as himself, and a woman should fear her husband. The language in the Greek is fear. Mm. Yeah, I'm not a big fan of that, Zach. I don't know about
you. I don't like it either.
Yeah. So I think it, for me, what that does is it makes me hold tightly. Like, if I used to hold tightly to what these scriptures were saying, it makes me hold a little less tightly. I want to be able to say, there are some good nuggets in here. And I ultimately always want to respect where someone else is coming from. I'm not on any kind of crusade here. I'm not.
Yeah.
I used to.
Okay, but what do you say to the purist who's like, well, you can't just pick and choose what you like in the Bible?
Well, then I'm going to ask them to do all these other things that they aren't aware they're missing out on. You know, like kind of what you were saying beforehand, right? Like, the clothes you're wearing right now, is there a mixture of polyester and cotton? Because if so, then I need you to remove that, because that's not appropriate. You know, like start with the simple stuff, you know?
So it's almost like unconsciously we already agree that we are living in a context, right? I mean, unconsciously we are, because I'm putting on these clothes and I'm like, I'm not even thinking about the fact that there's mixed fibers in here. Like,
right. Why does it matter? Right.
Yeah.
It doesn't to you.
Interesting.
We are all cherry picking which passages matter to us.
Okay. Wait, we're going back to Genesis. In Genesis, there's this idea, man will leave mom and dad, be united to his wife. The two will become one flesh. That's how you understand it?
No. I understand it that a man will leave his parents and join to his woman, not his wife.
Okay. Join to his woman and the two will become one flesh.
Yeah.
So how important, because I use this a lot, but I concentrate on the verbs.
Sure.
Not on the pronouns, right?
I think that's leave, appropriate.
Be united.
Yeah. Become one. Mm-hmm.
How important are the pronouns? How important are like kind of the objects of these verbs? Like, is it about a man? Is it about a woman? Is it about a wife? Is it about a, you know, what do you think? Because again, you're parsing the language quite clearly, but what's
why
the point?
Do I care? Yeah.
Why yeah. What's making, the point of that point little that? Section there?
Well, for one thing, it's one of the main passages that people turn to justify the belief that sex before marriage is a sin.
Right.
Because
become one flesh. That's us mashing bodies together.
Right. Yep. And the translators have told us they are now married before they become one flesh. But the language in the Hebrew does not change. It's a man and a woman in verse 23. And it's a man and a woman in verse 24. And it's a man and a woman in chapter 3 and chapter 4, because there is no Hebrew noun for wife and husband. It is just man and woman. Or there are labels for the man as a lord, master, and all those other things. But there's no husband-wife language in the Hebrew Bible.
Okay.
Ever. Same goes for the verb to marry, by the way, which is not your point or your question, but there isn't a verb to marry. It's almost always, like 90% of the time, it's the verb to take, as in a man goes and takes from her family a woman, purchases her, whatever, take. Not do you take this person, do you take this person, but.
Yeah, but can I get this person to establish my property rights, or can I get this person to establish my.
Will they give me sons? Yeah.
Yeah. Interesting.
Isn't it?
So, yeah. Okay. But also I it was a little bit of a curveball in there, because I kind of thought you were going to do the man. And when you were talking about the man and woman thing, you were going to talk about, there was going to be this commentary on same sex notion, but like it wasn't, you were talking man and woman as opposed to husband, wife, not necessarily man and woman as opposed to man, man or woman, woman.
Yeah.
What do you where's your study taking you in that space?
In the same sex?
Yeah, I guess couple. So. I mean, it's the question out there, right? Like, is that allowed? You know?
Yeah. I've started doing a series of short videos that I call Does the Bible Tell You So?
Yeah.
And have you seen them? No.
No. I mean, no. I have. I have not watched them, no, but when I was researching, I noticed that there were a couple of them out there. So
cool.
I'll have to take a look for sure.
I didn't mean any sort of pressure. You have a lot on your plate. But yes, I start out with some easier topics, and then I did three different sessions on some version of homosexuality or the sex act passages, which is what some of the clobbers are. They're talking about sex acts. They're not actually talking about a person who might be homosexual. So I did a separate video on that. And then I just did the sin of Sodom, you know, what it actually is. So, you know, I think it's a longer conversation than I can give just a simple response to. What I think is interesting is that there are biblical stories that give a nod to acknowledging that there are people who have sexual desires for, are attracted to people of the same sex. There are biblical stories that do that, and they are prime characters, actually.
Okay.
And they're not being judged for that. They're actually an important part of the storyline, or an essential part of the storyline.
Yeah.
So what could we expect from an ancient text? Could we expect an ancient text in their specific context to embrace homosexuality, you know, gay, lesbian, bisexual, like not in their specific location with all the things that they were trying to define for themselves over and against the people around them? No, I don't think we should even expect that. And so people want to say, since it's not in there, that means that God doesn't approve of it. Well, here's the thing about that is, in my opinion, is there are things that we do approve of today that are not in there. Mm-hmm. Does that mean we don't get to approve of them because they're not in the Bible? Yeah. And primarily what I mean there in this conversation with you, Zach, is people want to affirm a loving marriage entered into by two equals, mm-hmm. mutually choosing to enter into it. That isn't represented in the Bible anywhere.
Yeah. Isn't that mind-blowing?
Yes. Right?
It's like, because it sounds like you want this, but that's not in this book that you...
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I want people to be in loving relationships that are mutually entered into, right?
Of course, no coercion,
thanks. Right. So, you know, just
that's
because...
That's mind-blowing. Right. The notion that we have of a marriage right now, that there are two people who love each other mm-hmm. and who are choosing each other mm-hmm. and who are interested mm-hmm. in mm-hmm. even deepening their value set together. Mm-hmm. That's not represented
biblical.
In the text.
It's not biblical. Yeah. And the passage that people like to turn to, I memorized 1 Corinthians 13 to read at my brother's wedding, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
That's not addressed to couples. That's addressed to a community.
Huh. Yeah.
Right. And it's lovely. And we won't get into that.
Yeah. No, I'm with you, man. Listen, if all this does is make people go, "Ugh, what? That's fine. Like we don't need to solve anything. We need to stir things up because, but okay. I don't think I got the answer to this question. This idea out of Genesis, the leave and be united and become again, what's the point? Like, what is that? What is the invitation there for the reader?
Well, there are a couple different layers. I'll try to be concise and not get into everything, I think, because I think if we read Genesis 2, like that section of Genesis 2, I think it is trying to talk about a nearly universal, but not every human wants this, but nearly universal human desire to find a partner, like to find somebody to, you know, join up with, right? And in their context, yeah, sure, they're talking male, female, but I think this is talking about a human desire for companionship. I mean, if you look at the opening part where God breathes life into the human, that's not a male, it's just a generic human, which a lot of people don't know. And okay. I get that, but I like talking about it. And then God says, hey, it's not good for this human to be alone. So
yeah,
companionship, right? Like that's what this part of the story is trying to talk about. And so, you know, God trots out all the animals. Unfortunately, none of those worked. mm-hmm. Not a fan of bestiality.
Yeah.
And so, you know, and the cues that we were given, you know, how to read a story when it has near the end of the story, therefore, like look to mm-hmm. see what it's there for. That's what we've been building to is, and there is this other tangent here of this is interestingly giving a nod to the matriarchal societies around the Hebrew people or Israelite, that men went to the women. They went to their families instead of women leaving theirs to join the man's, which is just kind of a fun little, artifacts, something left over that's still in there. Mm-hmm. It's kind of interesting because it doesn't say the woman leaves her family and joins him, but he leaves his family and goes over anyway. But back to the point, in my opinion, is that this is talking about life partnership. And they didn't have language for marriage and they didn't have language for, you know, the way we do, you know, like engaged and married or, you know, like women in particular tend to change their labels, right? Miss to Mrs. were indicating a change in status. They didn't have that same change in status being indicated.
Yeah. That's crazy. I think people need to have experiences of having their whatever they assume kind of just being turned on its head a little bit. And that's why I'll vacuum out the kind of the objects of those verbs. And I'll talk about leave because you do need to establish like a clear boundary between sort of what was mm-hmm. and then like whatever is going to be next. Right.
Agreed. And then, yeah.
So sometimes that's mom and dad, sometimes at the apartment that you lived in.
Yeah.
Like try to move into his house and now it's his house. And that's like, but, you know, or then, you know, be united is really about kind of, this is now the new decision we're making. And then I like become because it's an active verb, right? It's never sort of never stops. That's the mystery part that I really like. Like this is a profound mystery that we have to sort of suss out and continue to sort of sort of figure out. Because the other thing, of course, is that, I don't know, I'm kind of getting on my own little horse right now, is that, you know, people will say something like, "You're not the man I married." And I'm like, thank God. You know, I thank God Rebecca, I'm not the man Rebecca married. That was a 23-year-old, 24-year-old, you know, punk, knew everything. And so sort of the idea that we have to have room to change and become and sort of transform into the thing. But yeah. Okay. So that's Genesis. Then we fast forward to Ephesians. There's this idea of the mystery. I'm kind of stuck too on this idea of the fear. Like, how do you make sense of that for people who are like, wait a second, I'm supposed to submit and the fear and all this stuff. I mean, is it really just the nuance of the language, or is there something else that is trying to be communicated?
It's a shift to something more patriarchal than what the early church movement had. So I think, I think early on there were moments or pockets of affirming women in leadership. And Paul himself even has parts of some of his letters where he doesn't talk to married couples very often, which is probably good since he was celibate, but it's not really a good idea to give advice on something you don't know what you're talking about. But he does talk to, like in 1 Corinthians 7, he talks about the way he talks about people being married to each other and their bodies belonging to each other. There are some red flags there for me in modern terms, because I belong to myself and no one else, but the mutuality, I think is what he's trying to get at there, I think is really lovely. And it's one of the only times in the entire Christian Bible where you have someone speaking about a married couple as equals. And I think that's part of why the early Christian movement got in trouble, is they had, you know, this egalitarian spirit and women were actually leading and slaves were even actually leading. That's a whole nother tangent. But that's part of why it's kind of like the backlash thing. It was getting them in trouble. It got some attention. It helped them get some numbers, but it also politically from the outside looked sketchy. And so you have this, okay, well, let's get back to those patriarchal, strict. Yeah. Males are dominant. Women are submissive. Let's be very clear to the outside world that we are submitting to those good household roles and rules. So I don't want to ignore or excuse that language in Ephesians. It's phobos. It's fear. It's it. The opening of the section in Ephesians 5, it's, you know, talking to women about fearing. It's language that, you know, it's not okay with me, but I want to be honest that that's what it is.
Yeah. Interesting. And I wonder what the benevolent version of fear is. I mean, obviously none of us would be like, oh yeah, I husband by fear, you know? I mean, maybe not obviously, and none of us. I mean, I think that is definitely the patriarchy as a giant capital P thing in quotes definitely exists. And the impact is still there. I mean, it's toxic and it's problematic, but I wondered if there's an invitation to fear, what is the version of that that looks closer to mutual respect or mutual regard or mutual, you know, sort of shared appreciation.
And I think that if but I think you just need to be honest that you're saying that you're looking at the fact that this is an ancient idea. However you want to understand the scriptures being inspired, this is, it does have language that is detrimental to females. It's also detrimental to males when you require that males be in that role all the freaking time. Like, I don't think it's helpful for either side. And I also don't like talking in just dualities, but if you want to move into space where you want to talk about mutuality and love and generosity and forgiveness and understanding, I think that's appropriate. You just don't get to turn to the Bible for it.
Okay. All right. That's fair. that's the money quote right there. Hey, so here's all my notes. I'm just going to tell you, you can write these down for your book.
Should I be, will you send me a recording?
Take notes real quick. Well, because, so on the backside, on the front side is the things that we've already said that I'll start with P: procreation, property, polygamy, profit, peace. I went and I found little proof texts for myself and all of those places. power, I think, was on that list, but it's not personal preference. You're saying personal preference is never really part of the biblical definition, like mutually choosing.
What do you mean by personal preference? That I'm...
That's what I mean. Like, hey, you're cute. Hey, you're cute too.
Okay.
I kind of love you. I kind of love you too. We're kind of doing... Like, there's plenty of fish in the sea, but I choose you, fish. Like, that's not really the scene.
I think, you know, it isn't. And I think that there's... I need to point out that Rebecca is the first woman who's sought out in the Genesis story. And she seems incredibly game, you know, which is great. She plays along really nicely. And they reiterate twice how much Isaac's servant slave pays her family for her, you know? Mm. But according to the storyline, she goes along, she plays along quite nicely. So there's a question there in my mind. Well, of course, she's excited about finding someone that she's going to be able to survive with, because it is a matter of survival. And it's, you know, like, I mean, it's a different culture. It's a different world. Also, it's another conversation to say men are writing these stories. So to what extent was she actually game, and to what, you know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
So we can see things like Michal loved David. Well, he didn't love her, so I don't know. Like, you know what I mean? Uh-huh. It says that Isaac loved Rebecca, but we don't have anything to back that up except for the fact that she was hot.
Mm. Well, Rebecca is hot. I'll tell you that.
And so is Rachel, apparently. Yeah.
My wife's name is Rebecca. Don't forget throw that in there.
That's good. That's good.
Well, okay. So in my post... What do we do with all this stuff? Here's some more piece for you. And you, the one of them is yours. I got it from you. It's permission, right? Permission to think differently about whatever a biblical marriage is. We need that. And that can only come from perspective. Look at me.
Look at you.
Crushing it with the peas. And that's a process to sort of figure it out. I mean, and there's this idea of a profound mystery. It also starts with P. But geez, there's so much here. And I just hope people will play with it, because it seems so easy to get hooked on things like, what was it? Like the purity movement. Like that starts with P too. Like that, because, and justify it with all of these sort of very narrow views of what it is that the Bible is actually saying. So I don't know. I'm glad to talk to you. I'm glad to get more permission and perspective. I hope, listeners, that's been fun for you too. Mm. Okay. I want to ask you one more question, because I feel like this is going to come up. What do you do with the idea that God hates divorce?
Yeah. And that's actually that passage, right? In Matthew 19, it's also in a couple other places, but it's the same basic idea. I know you might not like my answer, but I want to go look at both what the passages that Jesus and the Pharisees he's talking to, the passages they're drawing upon. And I want to talk about why divorce was a problem. Why is divorce a problem in these contexts? It's all focused on the sex. It's all about a woman having sex with someone. And so she's having sex with this man that who now has claimed her as her first husband, and now he divorces her, and they're both going to move on, and he's going to have sex with someone else, and she is too. Interesting assumption. And you can't do that. And it's all around territorial issues and ideas about sex, and in particular, a woman's body for that sexual encounter. And I also want to suggest that people look beyond verses 4-6, which is why I think it's interesting that people take that out of context to say this defines biblical marriage. Because if you read the whole exchange in the rest of, you know, the next few verses in Matthew 19, Jesus' disciples are like, well, if that's the case, then we shouldn't marry to begin with. And he doesn't say, no. They're like, it's better not to marry to begin with. And he's like, well, actually, if you can handle it, go castrate yourself for the kingdom. So he's this discussion among rabbis about which reason for divorce are you okay with is how it starts out. And he plays along by trotting out the same passages that they're arguing with. And then he ends up by saying, if you can handle it, chop those balls off. And what does that mean? That doesn't mean that men are to be abstinent or celibate. It means something very different in the first century to be a eunuch. And it is not, by the way, asexual. It is something entirely different.
That's insane. So God doesn't hate divorce. Wait, hold on.
So Why does God hate divorce? That's the question then. If you want to ask the basic question, why is it, what does it say in scripture? Why God hates divorce? Cause it's about women's bodies and vaginas. Like,
interesting.
Only one penis gets to go in there. Like, what?
I'm into it. My mom will be thrilled. She loves hearing it. Hearing us talk about penises and vaginas on the podcast. And so,
good.
I didn't even tell her that I was talking to you, but I think she'll be delighted. I think this episode is going to come out right before Christmas. So it'll be a gift for everybody in the, in the Marriage Therapy Radio land. Jennifer Bird, how do people figure out how to find you?
The easiest way is to go to my website, which is my full name, jennifergracebird.com. And all the other things. Yeah. All the other things.
Some of your videos are there.
Mm-hmm. My videos. I have the series of YouTube videos. You know, you can get, I have a link on my website to get you to my YouTube channel for those. Yeah.
Cool. I love it. Did we miss anything? Is there anything that we didn't get?
I do want to, I don't know if you're even aware of this, but I did create a series of videos about 3 years ago. The video series is called Marriage in the Bible, A Discussion Among Friends. And it is my attempt to help people from communities of faith. I had Methodists and Presbyterians in mind, just to be honest, who are having this conversation, and it's going to divide their denominations, whatever, this issue of what to do with, how to handle this reality of homosexuality, gay marriage, gays and lesbians, bisexual people want to be married to, all of that. So I'm never interested in trying to tell someone what to think or believe, but I am very invested in asking people to consider what the Bible actually is and isn't saying. So this video series is my attempt to offer like 15, 18 minute, like videos of content. And then I'm expecting that people will be watching it with friends and they will work through it together. So I don't know if that appeals to you or anyone, you know, that's out there, and you can access those through my website also. And I have like a leader's guide that I put together because it's dense. It's really a dense video series, to be honest. It's not for everyone.
That's great. I love it. I love it. I think people ought to do dense thinking about things that they kind of have come to assume for no reason without even knowing why they assume it, because it just makes for richer, deeper, more thoughtful engagement in this stuff. And that's where, again, I really wanted to have a conversation that was not simply about sort of what are you supposed to say? I don't want to know that. I want to agree that I don't know what I'm supposed to say. And so that's why we have to pay attention.
I like it.
All right. Well, thank you. And it was good to see your face. We're coming back east for Christmas, but I don't think we'll hit Roanoke, but, I loved reconnecting with you, and I appreciate you and your work.
Thank you, Zach. Goodness. That means a lot. It's really good to see you too.
So there it is. Thanks again for listening to Marriage Therapy Radio. If you enjoyed that conversation with Jennifer Bird, please check out her book. It's called Permission Granted. I loved it. Glad you got to know my mom a little bit. And again, I hope you have a happy holidays from Marriage Therapy Radio. I'll take a moment to thank you once again for the time and attention you put into making your relationship better today than it was yesterday.